Mr. Black, Reel 6. Can you take me through the constitution, the way in which a light attack regiment was put together in various parts?
Yeah. Well, first of all, as in all the previous activities, etc., we had the regimental headquarters. And as I said earlier, when we're invited for to become light anti-aircraft, the junior battery was taken away from the regiment. So instead of four companies as we had on the searchlights, we are now the three batteries and regimental headquarters. Each battery had four sections, and they were what happened when they took the one battery away, they also took a troop away from each of the sections, so we're left with three troops to the battery. Each troop had six detachments with a mobile light anti-aircraft gun. The personnel were more or less the same as in searchlights. There was about 10 people to each detachment. But of course, the duties changed completely. You had two and three were they controlled the movement of the gun. I mean the elevation and the horizontal movement. You had another gunner who was he was on the loading. He stood on the loading platform for to load the gun. The NCO stood at the back of the gun. He was in command. He stood at the back, and his job was when these gun layers were operating, if he spotted a target anywhere near, and I mean they might not see, he had the swivel handle, and he could move that gun to wherever the target was, and give them the layers a chance to lay onto it. Again, we had another man who was, he was generally an NCO, who did the layoff, because, I mean, again, as within the sound locator, I mean, you had to estimate the speed of an aircraft, which, and it was a bit funny, this one, because although an aircraft could be at constant speed in relation to the gun, the speed changes dramatically. I mean, an aircraft can approach slowly, and then as it gets near, it appears to go faster, and it has to be compensated in the laying off, as we called it. And that was just a clock sight in those particular days. You had to be reasonably accurate on that. Of course, in the battery, you had troop headquarters in each, and then you had your troop headquarters personnel, you had your battery headquarters personnel, your quartermasters and things like that. More or less, the administrative side was more or less the same, virtually the same complement of officers, NCOs and men as the searchlights.
What was the gun?
It was a Bofors 40mm gun.
Can you describe it to me?
Well, it was an automatic gun, obviously 40mm shell. A very, very effective gun as well. Used, it's still being used. Fired 120 rounds a minute. And the rounds, the fuses were so delicate that they reckoned if it hit a hailstone, it could explode the shell. They were designed to explode on impact, but they had a built-in safety device which, when it got the extreme range, detonated the shell. So you had no, there was no risk of a live shell sort of plunging back to Earth if it missed its target.
It was a Swedish gun,
yes. Uh-huh. Powerful explosive as well. I think it's an explosive still being used today, the RDX as they called it.
The actual loading process?
Well, they were in clips of five, and the loader stood on the platform, and he received the ammunition from the gunner that was standing by the ammunition box. He lifted the clip of shells. And as they were fired, and they could be fired automatically or single shot, if he put his foot down, I mean, just like that, that was the ammunition gone, and you had to have another clip in. I mean, it was difficult to maintain 120 actual shots per minute because of the rate of fire. I mean, we weren't encouraged for to use automatic, unless, you know, you thought he stood a chance, he's coming at you. I think where the Bofors scored, and they did score, was in Crete when the dive bombers used to come down, and the Bofors guns really, they had a field day because the young guys just used to come straight down to the guns, and the guns were firing directly at them. I mean, there was no question of layoff, anything like that. So, I mean, I had no experience there, but I should have think that was the time when automatic fire was very useful. Get as many shots off as possible.
So someone would have to be getting the shells to the gun itself, well, pretty rapidly.
Oh yes, well, see, you had your ammunition box very close to the gun. And you had the loader on the platform, and you had one or even two men sort of handling the clips of ammunition up to the loader. He also fired the gun. The chap that actually loaded them in, he also pressed the foot pedal to fire.
Foot pedal.
Yeah.
Had it any defects?
Not that I know of. I couldn't say it had a very efficient gun.
And could it fire from the horizontal?
Oh, it could from horizontal right to vertical. I mean, amongst the ammunition that we had anti-tank ammunition because it was a fairly effective anti-tank weapon. We did use it as an anti-tank weapon in northwest Germany or northwest Europe.
And its field of fire, could it turn around 360 degrees?
360 degrees, yes.
So that would set men running around, presumably.
Well, yes, but I mean, you didn't often get the chance for to use it around a 360 degree, especially at a low elevation. I mean, okay, if they're fairly high, you could do it, but obviously, a low elevation, you probably have your own troops or something behind you. In certain cases, you were given arcs of fire that you hadn't exceeded so many degrees left, so many right, and things like that, because of probably obstacles in the way. I mean, if you're in a town, there might be a big chimney or something like that. Well, you couldn't blast that. You had to be very careful. That principally applied to the static Bofors. We did on the Bofors. We did man static sites. And on these static sites, by then they had this. It was really a wonderful predictor. It was what they called the Sperry predictor, and that was again as the automatic remote control from the sounder cleaner to the searchlight. This Sperry predictor was automatically transmitted to the gun, so you had no gun layers. It became automatic, and it was. That was manned by a crew of three. You had it was generally an NCO, had the job of, again, what they call the laying off. But this case, it was done very accurately by very fine sights and a delicate mechanism. I mean, I did see the inside of it, and it was incredible, the mechanism in there. they reckon the graticules in the telescope sight were, they said they were manufactured by spiders. They're so fine. This particular, it was accurate. We in firing camp, when we used to fire at the drogues, you could get a very, very accurate shot. You put up to 2-3 shots into a drogue, no bother at all. Again, of course, the human element was in. I mean, if the NCO who was busy on it failed to sort of predict the target within the speed of the target within a specified range, you could miss it. They were too cumbersome for mobile. They were grand on, as I say, static sights. And there again, on the static sights, you had your field of fire, you had your arcs of fire, which you couldn't exceed.
Did you fire tracer?
I fired tracer. I think, well, it depended. Sometimes you loaded 1 in 5 or.
What was the purpose of putting a tracer in?
Well, it's to give you. I mean, when you start a fire, to give you an idea first of all where your shots are going.
Who would command a gun, one gun and crew?
It could, well, in normally on that establishment we had we got up to the fact that it was a sergeant that was in charge of the gun and crew. He had a sergeant and a bombardier on the side.
And in command of a group of guns above the sergeant.
Well, you had the troop sergeant, and of course the two officers, the troop captain and the troop lieutenant or subaltern.
Who commanded 112 Leiterkack at the beginning? Do you remember the colonel?
It was Colonel Squants at the beginning, yes. And then Colonel Iliffe took over.
And you said there was the regimental command, and then you came to batteries.
That's right.
And down through the scale.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you recall what happened to you when you went to Buxton? What were you doing there?
Oh yes, we did the actual gun drill on the guns that were taught. That was the first thing. There's the principles of a sort of artillery procedure as against the searchlights. It was a question of bringing the gun into action because of being mobile. You had big girders for to put out for to make the gun stable and this sort of thing. And there were specific jobs for each man to do when the gun was hauled into position. It was a question of learning all the gun drill, and I say learning how to use the gun, laying off, and this sort of business. And then we moved on to the mobile side of it, where you took the gun out and you had to get it into action in as quick a time as possible. It was very, very intensive training. I mean. I was when we were there. You had to do gun drill, but I was principally doing training on location of detachments and reconnaissance for sites and this sort of business. Because eventually, I had one of my jobs was to reconnoitre sites for the placing of the guns.
What would you look for in looking for a site?
Well, a good field of fire was the main one. I mean, obviously, when we're in Northwest Europe, a good field of fire with a maximum of concealment. You didn't want to be on. I mean, a good field of fire would be on top of the hill, but that's hardly the place if you've got somebody shooting at you.
And whilst you were in England, you would choose a site. Now, if that was on someone's land, how did you?
Oh well, I mean, this was all arranged beforehand. I mean, there was permission from the landowners to use it. We couldn't go sort of willy nilly and just pull into a farmer's field and say, right, I'm going to put the gun there, or in the middle of a park, I'm going to plonk my gun down here. Oh no, you were restricted to certain areas. I mean, we the principal place we did mobile training was around Eastleigh area in the New Forest and place. Well, there were places around there where you could you could sort of put your gun down.
At the amount of time, say, from getting an alarm when you're at rest, say, and getting the gun fired, ready for fire, how long would that take?
Well, obviously, if you weren't set up, I mean, if in the case of well, we're principally the regiment, principally engaged after we were jumping a little bit, but when we became fairly proficient on the guns, we're on the south coast against the hit and run raiders, and I mean, you couldn't have your gun sort of permanently on a site. You had it probably in troop headquarters, and then you were just given an instruction that they wanted you down such an... I mean, it could be up to 20, 30 mile away if they anticipated any action. And you just, it was as quickly as possible, that was it.
And you'd run your gun down to that side?
Oh, yes, you'd run anywhere right round the south coast from Barnstable in Cornwall, right round up the south coast to Biggin Hill and round that way. We covered at one time tremendous areas. There were static sites, of course, as well. And on a static site, it was a matter of minutes of getting out your gun, of course.
And did you have a permanent guard on the gun? I don't know, for the 24 hours of the
day? Oh, yes, yes. There was still you always had an air sentry on, even the Bofa gun. And probably a sentry on this side.
Where were you billeted in Buxton when you moved down there?
Well, I remember it, the old Empire Hotel. it had been made redundant before the war, but they opened it out again, and it was a big hotel, big building. That was the whole regiment was more or less in there.
And the guns themselves, where the training was, where
well, were they were parked in various places around it. They used the garages of the hotel for maintenance workshops and things like that.
And being in the hotel, and you were a corporal then at that point?
I was a bombardier then.
Oh. So what was your particular accommodation?
Well, I was in the billets with the men.
Was it a room or a hall?
It was a room, a fairly large size room.
And presumably there you had the day by day duties of
keeping the room clean. Because then the battery sergeant major, he was in his element. He'd come round with white gloves on and go round the top of the doors to see if there was any dust. That was the first time we're really. Came under sort of strict sort of military discipline. We adapted to it, but didn't take kindly to it.
Do you remember what your particularly battery sergeant's name was?
Yes, it was Baker, Sergeant Major Baker.
And was he a fair man? Was he?
Oh, he was a decent fella, but he was a disciplinarian, and that I think was it is the main job of a battery sergeant major. But we found when we went on to Light ACAC that your duties, apart from discipline, were very much wider. I mean, you had to be in the position of helping the battery captain and the battery commander to move a whole battery. You had to have knowledge for to do that. It was the same with the troops. And although he was, a great disciplinarian, when it came to that, he was a bit lost. In fact, he got very, very miffed with me, because when we did the actual troop movements, when we had batteries to move, when we had to do an exam at the finish of all our training, and I remember I came out top of the course, and he was somewhere down below, and mine, so were some of the officers. But it was just something I liked doing, I liked thinking about, and I could... I had been in the administration before I went into the army, and I was used to that sort of thing. And You had to think things through. I mean, when you move a troop of 80 men, that's quite a lot to do.
The battery commanders, that were they the same officers that you had as Searchlight battery commander?
No, we had the battery commander then was Major Lee. He joined us from. He was a territorial, but he was down from I think down the Midlands.
What was he like?
He was all right.
And was he artillery rather than engineers?
I think he'd always been sort of artillery.
And do you remember any of the other officers that were with you?
Oh yes, Buxton. Mm-hmm. Yes, we had my troop commander when I first became a troop sergeant, really a troop sergeant, and then a troop sergeant major was a local fella from South Shields, who was a Shield solicitor, Dean Winskill. We became very friendly after the war. In fact, he, while we're down at on static sites, about 1942, down at Grays and Essex and places, he did recommend me for a commission. So that's another story.
I should have asked you, but what were the maintenance duties on the gun? How was it maintained? Well, kept up to. You know.
Well, just in the normal way. I mean, obviously, I mean it was mounted on. It was mobile, mounted on wheels. You had a certain amount of greasing up and this sort of thing to do, and seeing all the mechanism worked correctly and was kept well oiled and greased. The gun was kept clean. The barrel was kept clean.
How was the barrel kept clean?
Well, we used what was called the Pierce Arbor brush. It was a sort of heavy bristle-come metal brush which was pushed down the barrel and worked. And then it was virtually the same as cleaning a rifle. I mean, you had your pull-through for your rifle, this was on a pole. And that every time you fired the gun, of course, that had to be done. And, of course, it periodically had to be done at maintenance, because you couldn't have any rust anything in the gun.
Any major problems? Were you capable of doing that on site?
Major problems. We had a team of mechanics who were based at headquarters, and they would come round. They came round periodically, inspected the guns to see that they were all right. That was on top of the officers' inspection and this sort of thing. But they were specialists in their own right. I didn't mention before, but on the Bofors gun, after you fired for so long, you had to change the barrels, and this was part of the drill on the Bofors gun.
Was that done?
It took four men to do that. So because the barrels were fairly heavy, and of course they're hot, we had sort of two big handles, and they turned the barrel a certain way, and then brought it out and put the replacement barrel in.
And you carry replacements, presumably.
There's a replacement barrel, yes.
Life in Buxton itself, whilst you were there, I'm thinking of the time when you had a little bit free time to yourselves. Mm. What did you do?
Actually, for us, it was one of the highlights of a sort of career up to then, because up to then, I mean, we'd had no entertainment whatsoever. I mean, the entertainment on Searchlight days was a question of movement at Darlington one day a week, if for 2 or 3 hours. But that was most of that was principally spent going to the public baths to get a decent bath and having a meal, and probably just look around the place, probably going to the cinema. But at Buxton, there was plenty to keep us going. I mean, by then, I mean, we took a drink, and there was one or two pubs. There was Naffy's there. There's YMCA's, and really the entertainment and the time off was great there compared. But having said that, we didn't get a lot, because we're active from first thing in the morning till about 5 o'clock at night.
The people, how did you get on with those? Did they welcome you?
Yes, I mean, never any. There was never any bother. I can't remember any. any punch-ups or anything. For all there was as many army troops there, there was very little bother. And yes, the local people, especially when you went to the likes of a church army canteen or one of the Salvation Army canteens, and they were always very, very welcoming.
And Buxton's was a brewery town, wasn't it?
Well, they did, yes.
So presumably that wasn't in short supply.
Well, there was a fair amount. I mean, beer in those days wasn't fairly.
What pay did you get as a bombardier?
I think when I was a bombardier, my pay went up to about 28 shillings per week.
Did you get any free issues or saves of cigarettes being in the army?
Not in this country, no.
No, that only happened abroad.
It only happened abroad, that, yes. In fact, you had to pay for quite a lot of things, the likes of toothpaste, even your soldier's friend for cleaning your buttons, and your dubbin for your boots and things like that. You buy that yourself.
And did you make an allotment home?
Oh, yes, I had to make an allotment home because my mother was a widow. And actually, I had to make a bit more than I normally would have done.
Yes. How much would that be?
Well, when I was on the 14 shillings a week when I first went in, you really had to make a compulsory allotment of 7 shillings. But because my mother got an allowance from the army, I had to contribute towards that. So I had to contribute 10 and 6 pence a week out of the 14 shillings. When I was a bombardier, I think I was contributing, I think it was about 18 shillings a week, and I was rich, I had 10 bob.
And that was sufficient for you?
Oh, yes, we seemed to manage all right, didn't it? We didn't get the chance, as I say, we weren't out every night sort of having a drink, and I mean, a pint of beer then was just about sixpence or something, sixpence to ninepence a pint, and didn't even drink a lot of that, a couple of halves, and that was it.
And did you have a weekly church parade on a Sunday?
Not in the sites, because there wasn't sufficient. That was only when you were when you're in the barracks proper. We did have a church parade at Buxton, but really until we got to the likes of Southborough, where we were based for some time. Church parades were. Strangely enough, when we're on the sites and round Great Smeaton, the detachment did fairly regularly go down the church. We made great friends with the people at the local church, and we used to attend the services voluntary for soldiers on a Sunday.